you could listen to a music mix like this. Play Focus Beats. Or try a new podcast. Play Desert Island Discs. And of course, if you want to listen to live radio, you can just say Play Radio 3. Music, radio and podcasts available on most smart speakers. Just say Open BBC Sounds to get started.
Next, Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest is the novelist and journalist, Susie Boyd.
Whether she's writing black comedies about dysfunctional families or about her passion for Judy Garland, Susie Boyd is unafraid to address the big questions in all our lives. Her seven novels explore how we can best take care of people, how we can survive life's inevitable traumas, and how we might live alongside the loss of people we love. Brought up in an unconventional household, the youngest of five children and the daughter of the painter Lucian Freud, her love of music, dancing and theatre has been with her since early childhood. Susie, I want to come on to talking about your life, your writing, but first, music. I know you go to a lot of concerts, but why does experiencing music live mean quite so much to you?
Well, I suppose I'm always mindful of what the musicians themselves are going through as they're playing, sort of looking at them, not just what their hands are doing, but also their faces and, I don't know, even their shoes, and just a sense of what it costs to give that much of yourself and the tremendous generosity involved and the rewards being quite meagre, and a sense of someone doing so much while I'm just sitting like a lump in a chair, kind of drinking it all in. And that's the sort of big part of it. When you're in a concert hall, the kind of extreme excitement that something might go slightly wrong or someone might drop their bow or that kind of thing.
We're going to hear music by Mozart and Britten, as well as ballet music and, of course, a song from Judy Garland. But first, Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 29, known as the Hammerklavier. You have a particular love of piano music, don't you?
Yes, I do. I often listen to it. I walk a lot around London and I often listen to it while I'm walking and have a sense of things falling into place in a kind of way that helps my own work.
Well, this is the slow movement, 15 minutes in all, so I'm afraid just part of it, and once described as a mausoleum of collective sorrow.
There's something initially very sort of stately and proud about the grief in this third movement. And even when it gets wilder towards the end, I feel it offers a sort of a new way into things that might help those who are proud to grieve.
Music from the third movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 29 in B-flat, the Hammerklavier, performed by Murray Pariah. Susie Boyd, we're going to hear ballet music next, and I think the reason for this partially is because you were passionate about dance as a child and even perhaps would have liked to have been a professional dancer.
Well, I was dance crazy from the ages of about 4 to 13, and I went to 4 or 5 dance classes a week, ballet, tap, and a very, very old-fashioned kind of dance that was called modern. And I was always practicing in my bedroom. I had using the mantelpiece as a bar, or I probably practiced several hours a day, and I loved it. I wasn't ever at all good, but I had a really good memory, which when you're a young dancer can get you pretty far if you're always doing the right step. It doesn't really matter how well you do it. And I had a record of ballet music that I used to listen to. I had Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty, and then this from Giselle, which I just loved. And it wasn't so good for doing exercises at the mantelpiece bar too, but for the later bit of the lesson where you did a sort of free expression and interpretation, it was brilliant for that, sort of thinking about what life might hold and what growing up could lead to.
And does the music remind you of, in a sense, the fragility of childhood, the vulnerability?
Well, one of the things I love so much about this is it seems to, just in a few minutes, to go from girlhood to go to late girlhood, then to young adolescence, and then to almost early womanhood, just in a few minutes. And I think Giselle's life is almost over as soon as it's begun, so it carries that very terrible sort of sadness. But even then, I can remember looking at the world about me as a young child and thinking that love seemed so dangerous. I couldn't believe anyone would risk it.
Did you embrace those dangers as you got older, or did that take some time for you?
I certainly put my toe in the water.
Well, we're going to hear part of the opening scene from Giselle as she steps out of her little cottage before everything goes so terribly wrong and she's destroyed by a philandering aristocrat.
Thank you.
Music from the first act of Adolphe Adam's ballet Giselle, with Nicolette Fréon conducting the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra.
Whenever I see ballet, I'm always mindful of not just the plot of the ballet, but what kind of day the dancers will have had and what they have to go through just to sort of give all that to us. The amount of painkillers they have to take just to get through an ordinary day and giving absolutely everything whilst taking in very, very little. And then ballet is so cerebral, ballet dancers being almost the sort of academics of show business and having to be so incredibly thoughtful and also so good at acting as well, which is very different from extreme self-discipline of the body.
Now, Susie Boyd, you write about fashion for the Financial Times, and I wonder if that passion really began with your mother, also called Susie, because, of course, she ran a vintage clothes shop, didn't she?
Well, she did. She was a painter by trade, but she sold old clothes to earn her living, and there was permanently a large cauldron of white nighties and bloomers and things boiling on our stove at home, and in the doorways of all the rooms in our house were 1930s crepe dresses and beaded cardigans and that sort of thing, which frequently fell on my head as I passed between rooms. And this was in the 1980s, so I had a very kind of Victorian childhood, and I often stayed up mending things or taking up hems, or we used to sometimes embroider lazy daisies on cardigans. And there was a lot of sewing and laundry. I knew a lot about starching and pressing and press studs and millinery velvet and sort of things, which certainly were not big topics in the playground.
You were close to your mother?
Yes, very, very close.
Youngest of five children, mother was a single parent. She really, to a certain extent, gave up her career as an artist to bring you all up. Do you think she ever regretted that?
It's hard to know. I mean, as soon as I was 18, she started painting all the time again. I suspect it would have been lovely for her to have been able to do both things. Perhaps it was a regret. And when she was at the Slade, she won two very major prizes, and she was really, really good. I've got lovely things that she did.
What name did she paint under?
Susie Voigt.
Oh, yes. Well, wonderful. So we can look out for her. Your father was Lucian Freud, and he was also the father of three of your siblings. So given these two sides of your family, it must have been quite a creative childhood, really.
Yes, I guess there was the sense of if you could make your work doing something made out of your insides, that was the sort of way to go, or what we were taught life was.
I'm interested that you said, I'm very Freudian in the way I look at things. Any character I ever create, I'm thinking about her parents and her parents' parents. Do you think that it's in your blood from your great-grandfather, Sigmund Freud, or a conscious choice?
I feel it's naturally how I see the world. I think it also comes from doing two English degrees where you spend a lot of time trying to get absolutely everything out of every sentence that you read and try and completely understand someone's motivation. Spending sort of 5 years at the coalface of doing practical criticisms isn't that different from a sort of psychoanalytic training, I think, where you're thinking, what's the absolute most this text can yield? And I think I've always seen life like that, so I'm always looking round corners. And I like that thing very great paintings often have, where there's something very significant going on in the middle and then tiny little side things that might have as much or even more to say about the world of the painting. And I think I've seen life like that always.
One thing you enjoyed sharing with your father was song, and a certain kind of song. And I think it's one of the things that you bonded over with songs and song lyrics.
Definitely. We were both huge fans of what's sometimes called the Great American Songbook. And we used to sing to each other when he did three paintings of me in my late teens and early 20s. And I certainly sang quite a lot then. And we both endlessly discussed lyrics that we didn't understand or lyrics that we thought could be improved on.
You've chosen a song by Garcilan, a star of early 20th century music hall. Why this song?
When I was at my primary school, it celebrated its centenary, and for some reason the headmistress decided to turn the whole school Victorian, and we were to dress as Victorians, and we learnt a lot of Victorian songs, and I think we might have even had horrendous Victorian school dinners, which were bad enough in the present day. But I particularly always liked this song, It's a Great Big Shame, partly because growing up it's such a familiar thing that you have a very close friend or even a best friend who you're completely in the pocket of each other, and then suddenly they strike up a romance and you don't hear from them for months. And this is a song about that, but from a man's point of view, he's absolutely heartbroken that his best friend can't come out to play anymore. Sometimes it's interpreted as being rather misogynist because the man thinks that his friend is utterly humiliated by the fact that he has to do quite a lot of household chores. But you could say, you know, his friend is a new man and taking on household responsibilities in an inspiring way. So it's just a combination of those things. And it's incredibly funny. There's one line where he says, "Now Jim was class, he could sing a decent song, and at scrapping he had won a great renown." And just that as a definition of a friend is just so fantastic.
I think you should have sung this to your father.
Perhaps it is my party piece, but I hardly ever do it because I need to have had about 11 drinks first.
"I've lost my pal, he's the best in all the town, but don't you think him dead because he ain't. But since he's wed, he has had to knuckle down, it's enough to wax the temper of a saint. He's a brewer's drayman with a leg of mutton fish, and as strong as a bullock or an horse. Yet in her hands he's like a little kid, oh I wish that I could get him a divorce. A great big shame, and if she belonged to me, I'd let her know who's who. A nagging at a fella what is 6'3", and her only 5'2". Hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her thumb goes Jim. How isn't it a pity as the likes of her should pat upon the likes of him? Jim was class, he could sing a decent song, and at scrapping he had won some great renown. Well, it took 2 coppers for to make him move along, and another 6 to hold the fella down. But today when I axes would he come and have some beer, to the doorstep on tiptoe he arrives. I dare say, says he, don't shout, cause she'll hear, I've got to clean the windows and the knives. Well, it's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me, oh, I'd let her know who's who. And nagging at a fella what is 6'3", and her only 4'2". Hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her fun goes Jim. How isn't it a pity as the likes of her should part upon the likes of him? On a Sunday morn, with 12 pals or more, he'd play at pitch and toss along the lee. But now she bullies him a scrub into the floor, such a change, well, I never did see. With a apron on him, I twig him on his knees, rubbing up the old half-stone. What with emptying the ashes and a shelling of the peas, I'm damned if he can call himself his own. Well, it's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me, I'd let her know who's who. And nagging at a fella what is 6'3", and her only 4'2". Hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her thumb goes Jim. How isn't it a pity as the likes of her should part upon the likes of him?
A nice thing they say about Gus Elan is that from early on in his career, he cultivated a very grumpy personality, which is probably a brilliant idea, and we all should have done it.
Gus Elan with It's a Great Big Shame, words by Edgar Bateman and music by George Lebrun, a recording made in 1931. You've written a lot about loss and grief, and you've trained as a bereavement counsellor. How do you think we should try to deal with loss and grief?
Well, I suppose everyone does it in very, very different ways. Personally, I like to do it quite privately, which one's friends don't always like.
Or understand.
No. I think, It sounds sort of idiotic, but my dignity is very important to me, so I like to experience difficult things quietly and alone often. But I am very interested in the way we can hold our losses very dear to us, or feel that without them we might have nothing to our name, or that there's something very powerful in them. But I'm also very aware of the ways that grief sort of undoes us, the way it makes us paranoid, because if the worst thing in life has happened, you know, what's going to happen next? The way it takes our skills and our interests away, or the popular advice to sort of keep busy after bereavement, I always think is hopeless, because almost everything you do, you'll get wrong and you'll have to do again. And also the way grief assaults the personality. If you suddenly don't like the things you've always liked, what are you meant to like instead? But I suppose for me, what works best is a bit like after a baby is born. If you hold the idea of the lost person close to you for as long as possible, and also work out what your family is going to look like now without a sort of key member in it anymore. And I think that there's hardly any time or space to do that in modern life. There's such a sort of strong culture of productivity that anything that seemed to take away from productivity is looked down on, or sort of terrifies people, in an idea that if you start crying, you'll never stop, or no one likes a misery. And there are so many things that people say and do to make grief feel sort of disenfranchised. There's funny, in bereavement counselling, there are many books about disenfranchised grief, and the joke is you may as well just call it grief, because hardly anyone feels entitled to sort of grieve for quite a long time. And, you know, the idea that you might sit down with a box of letters or whatever the modern equivalent is and really sort of commune with that person is, you know, very few people have the kind of life where that's possible anymore, and I think that is regrettable.
Mm. Music next, Run Through with Vulnerability, Death. It's from Benjamin Britten's The Turn of the Screw, adapted from the novella by Henry James. Is he a writer who speaks strongly to you?
Very much. I've been reading Henry James since I was a teenager, and I actually still belong to two Henry James reading groups, or support groups as they're sometimes called. And I'm always reading them, and they change as I change and as I get older. I do feel that Henry James explained my life to me in some ways, just the sense of someone really trying to lay bare the whole landscape of human consciousness. There's nothing I'm more interested than I am in that. And also he's so brilliant on not just actual ghosts, which finally aren't that interesting, but all the things that haunt us, whether they be sort of regrets or loss or mistakes. And the world of Henry James was never a good place to be a child, and these children are sort of more vulnerable than you could possibly imagine. They're right at the very edge of what can be born. They also occupy a place that's much more usual for elderly people, and they know many more people who are dead than they know people who are alive, which gives them a very strange kind of otherness, which I think makes them so hard to deal with for the governess. But just thinking about the prologue, beautifully sung by Ian Bostridge, I feel that it's such a brilliant mixture of precision and sort of sharpness while setting out the beginning for a tale that's kind of extremely fraught and ambiguous. And I think those things are really, really startling to listen to.
It's a curious story. I have it written in faded ink, a woman's hand. Governess to two children long ago. Untried, innocent, she had gone first to see their guardian in London, a young man, bold, offhand and gay, the children's only relative. The children were were in the country with an old housekeeper. There had been a governess, but she had gone. The boy, of course, was at school, but there was the girl, and the holidays now begun. This then would be her task, but there was one condition. He was so much engaged. Affairs, travel, friends, visits. Always something. No time at all for the poor little things. She was to do everything. Be responsible for everything. Not to worry him at all. No, not to write, but to be silent. And do her best. She was full of doubts, but she was carried away that he, so gallant and handsome, so deep in the busy world, should need her help. At last, I will, she said.
Ian Bostridge performing the prologue from Benjamin Britten's opera The Turn of the Screw, a recording with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra conducted by Daniel Harding. And of course you can find details of all the music chosen by my guest today, Susie Boyd, if you go to the Private Passions webpage. And if you search BBC Sounds, you can enjoy hundreds of previous editions of the programme. Susie, I mentioned your book, My Judy Garland Life, about your lifelong obsession with her. What is it about Judy Garland that makes you identify with her so closely, love her so much?
It started really with her way of communicating completely unadulterated feeling. And I was a really sensitive child, the sort of child whose heart went out to a little bit of mustard left on the edge of the plate. Life is sort of tough when you're like that. And also no one really knows what to do with you. And when I heard Judy Garland singing, first of all, like most people in The Wizard of Oz, here was someone whose feelings seemed to run as high as my own, and she wasn't afraid of it or ashamed of it or embarrassed about it. She was leading with strong feelings as if they were the very, very best thing a person could have. And so I suppose for me, it felt that something I viewed as an affliction might just be the making of me or the best thing about me. And so that was a sort of great piece of news, and that if you were very sensitive, life would cost more, but it also might sort of yield more.
I'm very fascinated by the way this combination has run through what we've been talking about and the music, this combination of fragility and strength, which actually produces something fresh.
Yes, I mean, behind it, with my love of musicals and Judy Garland particularly, is a knowledge that there's almost no human situation so awful that it can't be transformed by the singing of a wonderful song. And that also, even when she's playing a character who's suffering or appears to be suffering herself, the facts on the table of being quite that good at something somehow speak against or sort of show down the difficult thing that's being experienced. So it is a sort of proper armour and a defence against adversity or difficulty or any kinds of wounds or hurt.
As such an ardent fan, and knowing the lyrics and the songs as well as you do, it must be very difficult to choose one.
Well, it was very, very hard to choose, but And I could have chosen all seven, but I chose It Never Was You, a Kurt Weill song, which is originally from a pretty odd musical called Knickerbocker Holiday, I think, which is based on a Washington Irving book giving a sort of parody of a false history of New York from the 17th century. And in that show, the song is sung by two lovers who are sort of cruelly parted by the woman's parents and then reunite. But when Judy sings it, it's about a lot more than that. She's very much not singing about a reconciliation or a reunion. She's singing about something that isn't there and that was very likely never there, not just for her, but not for anyone. She's singing about a sense that we have now and then, that the strength of the absences in our life might count more strongly for us than what we've actually got, which is a sort of unbearable feeling. And one of the things I've tried to really address in my work is how we bear the things we can't bear, which everyone has to do now and then.
I've been running through rain and the wind that follows after, for one certain face and an unforgotten laughter. I've been following signs, I've been searching through the land for a certain pair of arms and a certain pair of hands. Yes, I tried a kiss here and I tried a kiss there. For when you're out in company, the boys and girls will pair. Sunset reminded me, or a flower hanging high on a tulip tree, or one red star hung low in the west, or a heartbreak call from a meadowlark's nest made me think for a moment, maybe it's true, I found him in the star, in the car, in the blue, but it never was you.
When I listen to It Never Was You and to much of Judy's best work, I'm not completely sure where her feelings end and mine begin. And of course, that's a kind of state of mind that's traditionally attributed to what passes between mothers and babies, that it's unclear what branch of feeling belongs to whom, and that's sort of how deep it goes when I listen to her.
It Never Was You by Kurt Weill and Maxwell Anderson, performed by Judy Garland for the 1963 film I Could Go On Singing. The pianist was Dave Lee. Susie Boyd, is musical theatre for you the epitome of showbiz, of glamour?
Yes, I am of the soppy strain of humans that thinks show business is the highest calling in the land.
Why are people snobbish, do you think, about musical theatre and musicals?
It's hard to know. I mean, when people talk about musicals being easy listening, even if you think of the very most famous ones, they involve compulsive gambling or domestic violence. These are not easy subjects. And a show like Gypsy that I've chosen the overture from, really takes you apart piece by piece as you watch. And if you're lucky, puts you back together again. I was thinking of that old-fashioned game Operation one used to play, where with tweezers you take away the larynx and the heart and all the things out of the cardboard man and then put them back in again. And I think the way in which musicals can really undo you, and then the catharsis involved of them putting you back together again, is a bit impossible to experience in any other kind of 2-hour, 45-minute situation. I was just thinking that T.S. Eliot described his second marriage to Valerie as pneumatic bliss. And when I listen to this, I think of pneumatic bliss.
The overture to Gypsy, Julie Stein's 1959 musical, Milton Rosenstock conducting the original Broadway cast recording. Your music choices, Susie Boyd, have brought us very much a feeling of someone, to a certain extent, unafraid to engage with powerful emotions, positive and negative. And in a sense, from that point of view, reflect your writing. Do you think that's fair?
Yes, I think of my books as being dark books with high spirits. And when we were talking about Henry James before, a great thing that I took from him was a theme both in my work and in my life of sort of how to be good in the world without taking on any of the taint that the word worldly carries, how to properly engage with life and try and be good without getting mashed to a pulp kind of thing. And that's something that some of these pieces have carried and I've investigated also in my work.
Given your feelings about emotions, mood, feelings, I wonder which ones prompted your choice of our final music?
I've always loved the adverb unfailingly, and I feel that that really applies to this piece. It also seems to me to have a lot of light and clarity to it, and things that have light and clarity often seem to me a little bit trivial, but this isn't trivial in the least, and the sense of certainty is very, very inspiring. I listened to it quite a lot in lockdown when there wasn't much certainty to be found, and we were all carrying around sort of splinters of difficult things. And I think in lockdown, a lot of difficulties that had been long put away by me and the people I knew and people I loved and also sort of strangers, lots of things came back and sort of re-reared their ugly heads. And there was something about this that was very, very lacking in any kind of misgiving. And I think at a time when there were sort of only misgivings, the unmisgiving quality was really valuable.
It's Mozart's Piano Sonata, Kirkel 545, played by Mitsuko Ushida. Do you think that has anything to do with the choice of music? Because you've been quite interested in particular performances up until now.
Yes, I've seen her play quite a lot of times and greatly admire her and always see her when she's on if I can. It's interesting, I was watching her play, just sort of watching her face rather than her hands and feeling that the lightness and clarity of the piece is hard won and perhaps more difficult to convey than something that's more obviously complex.
Mm. So it only remains for me, Susie Boyd, to thank you very much for sharing your private passions with us today.
Thank you.
Mitsuko Uchida with the slow movement of Mozart's Piano Sonata in C. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Susie Boyd. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood, and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. Private Passions returns next Sunday at noon, when Michael's guest will be Wayne Sleep. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. Boris Johnson has warned Rishi Sunak not to water down the legislation he introduced on Brexit as the Prime Minister pursues a new deal with the EU. Mr Sunak wants to change the rules governing trade in Northern Ireland, but Mr Johnson said he shouldn't ditch proposed laws that would allow the UK to scrap parts of the Brexit deal. The EU regards dropping those proposed laws as essential to any new agreement. The Leader of the Commons, Penny Mordaunt, said Mr Johnson's intervention was not completely unhelpful. The former Northern Ireland Secretary, Labour's Lord Mandelson, has accused Boris Johnson of wanting to undermine his successor. The US says China is considering supplying Russia with weapons for its war in Ukraine. America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, warned Beijing there would be consequences if it sent Moscow arms. His Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi, said his country had neither stood by idly nor thrown fuel on the fire during the war in Ukraine. Two SNP politicians have announced they'll run to succeed Nicola Sturgeon as leader of the party and the First Minister of Scotland. The Scottish Health Secretary, Humza Yousaf, and the former minister, Ash Regan, are the first candidates to officially declare their leadership bids. Rescue teams in southern Turkey are winding down the search for survivors of the earthquake, which struck 13 days ago. More than 46,000 people are now known to have been killed by the quake in Turkey and Syria. The authorities of Muraş in southern Turkey said most international rescue teams had now left. The BAFTA award-winning filmmaker Christopher Newpen has died at the age of 88. Born in Johannesburg, Christopher Newpen started his career at the BBC in the UK. He went on to make 75 documentaries about classical music and composers. The King's coronation service in May will involve 12 newly commissioned pieces of music, including a composition by Lord Lloyd Webber. The King has personally chosen the music for the ceremony at Westminster Abbey. Today's weather, it'll be cloudy in northern areas of the UK with a band of heavy and blustery rain moving eastwards across northern Scotland. Drier and less windy in the south with spells of sunshine. Top temperatures of 13 degrees Celsius in London, 12 in Belfast, 10 in Cardiff and 9 in Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News. It's 2 minutes past one.
Bone shaking. Gut-wrenching, heart-racing, the visceral effect of a week of iconic 20th century classics on Radio 3 in concert. Paired with concertos showcasing the virtuosity of the piano with soloists including Angela Hewitt and Isitor Callie Mason.